I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. COVID relief is up in the air today after President Trump threatened last night not to sign the coronavirus relief bill. He's demanding $2,000 checks to Americans instead of the $600 that Congress approved.
The president's surprise video last night upended months of tense bipartisan negotiations and leaves struggling Americans unsure whether help is on the way just 2 days before Christmas. Meanwhile, health officials fear the holidays could lead to another spike in COVID-19 cases, piling onto the post-Thanksgiving surge that's already overwhelmed hospitals in some states. So let's bring in NPR science correspondent Rob Stein. And Rob, start with Christmas travel. It may push hospitals past their limits. So what's happening with the pandemic right now?
Yeah, Robin, you know, right now it's a very mixed picture in some ways. On the one hand, there's finally light at the end of the tunnel. You know, the vaccines are finally here and millions of doses are already being shipped out and hundreds of thousands of people have already gotten their first shots. On the other hand, the pandemic has really never been worse than it is right now in this country. You know, let's not forget more than 18 million people in the U.S. have already been infected with the virus. More than 322,000 have already died. And the virus is now spreading faster than ever. More than 200,000 people are being infected every day, and more than 3,000 are dying on some days. I talked about this with Dr. Carlos Del Rio at Emory University.
It's very grim. You know, we're seeing what I think it's an epidemic out of control. And we are seeing patients come to the hospital and we're seeing people continue to die. And it's just heartbreaking.
Out of control. Los Angeles quickly running out of beds. Tennessee leads the country in infections per capita. Talk about the hotspots.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really out of control from coast to coast, really, you know, from Rhode Island, New York, and Pennsylvania on the East Coast. You know, in addition to Tennessee looking really bad, Arkansas looks bad, so does Oklahoma, you know, Kansas, Arizona. So many people are hospitalizing California right now that there's talk about having to start deciding how to almost ration care. You know, doctors are facing the possibility of being forced to make these wrenching decisions about who has the best and who doesn't have the best shot at surviving.
What about this variant, this new strain of the coronavirus that's spreading in the UK?
Yeah, so that's something that scientists are watching very closely. It looks like it may spread more easily, but the good news is that it doesn't seem to be more deadly, and the vaccine should still work. This variant hasn't been detected in the U.S. yet, but it could be here and just hasn't been spotted. So, you know, scientists are urgently looking right now.
Yeah. And Rob, I want to jump to some more sound that you've brought us, because there's usually a lag time of about 2 weeks before these surges start showing up in the data, which means a rise in holiday cases would end up just between the Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration. So how is President-elect Biden planning to address this in his first days in office?
So, you know, Biden says he's going to try to provide a much more coordinated national response to the pandemic. You know, he's promising to do things like, you know, finally boost testing. Public health experts are welcoming this. You know, some projections say the death toll could exceed 400 or even 500,000, which had once been thought to be, you know, just unimaginable. Here's Dr. Yeah. Carlos Del Rio again from Emory.
We should all be, quite frankly, realizing that there's a lot we can do as individuals to actually prevent the transmission of this virus.
You know, so Del Rio and others are saying, you know, wear those masks and keep your distance from anyone you don't live with. they get that everyone's exhausted and fed up and yearning to see friends and family over the holidays. But public health experts are basically saying, you know, we get it, but there's hope. The vaccines are here. Just hold on and be careful so more of you can be here to celebrate the holidays together next year.
Yeah. Well, in the less than a minute we have, how is the rollout of that vaccine going? You know, we're a little over a week into the rollout to frontline workers. Several states didn't get the amount they were promised. Pfizer said they have doses just sitting in warehouses. So just briefly, how well is this going?
You know, there have been a few hiccups. You know, there was big confusion about how much vaccines the states would get this week. But the federal government is promising to fix that. And, you know, just today you mentioned the Trump administration announced a new deal to get 100 million more doses from the Pfizer vaccine. But, you know, vaccinating hundreds of millions of people is a huge, complicated undertaking. So it won't be surprising if more snags pop up along the way. And it'll take months, you know, many months before enough people get vaccinated to really stop this virus.
Yeah, we have to be patient. NPR science correspondent Rob Stein, thank you.
You bet, Robin.
And Pfizer announced today that the United States will buy another 100 million doses of its vaccine, which will be delivered by next summer. That doubles what the U.S. government had already ordered from Pfizer, and it's yet another sign that rich countries have an advantage in the race to vaccinate their citizens because they're able to sign these big contracts with pharmaceutical companies. Canada, for example, has ordered enough doses to vaccinate its citizens at least four times over. We've been reporting on vaccine nationalism, and we're going to go deeper now with Dr. Moga Kamalyani. She's a policy advisor to the People's Vaccine Alliance. It's a global collaboration of aid groups, and she joins us now on Skype. Dr. Kamalyani, welcome.
Thank you.
And the People's Vaccine Alliance has done some research. It now says that 9 out of 10 people in poor countries will miss out on the COVID-19 vaccine next year. That is alarming. Which countries are most at risk?
There's about 70 countries most at risk. Five of them have reported over 1.5 million cases between them. So that's like Kenya, Myanmar, Nigeria, Pakistan, and the Ukraine. This is just an example of all these, actually 67 low and middle income countries.
Well, there are organizations that are trying to make some headway here on this issue. A few days ago, we got word that the group known as COVAX, which is part of the World Health Organization's effort to get vaccines distributed to poor countries around the world, that it had secured 2 billion doses of the vaccine. How significant is that announcement? How far will it go?
Okay, so in theory, COVAX is a good mechanism. It should really be the global kind of, if you like, purchasing mechanism for everybody. In practice, that's not what's happening because they secure 2 billion doses. They're saying in the press release that 1.3 billion are going to developing countries. Now, the World Health Organization put this equitable allocation framework, which is defining who are the priority groups to get the vaccines. The priority is health workers, people over 60, and people under 60 who have chronic conditions. These groups together in any country are around 20% of the population, okay? So the vaccines that COVAX is going to give these countries, they're not going to cover 20% of the population.
Well, what you've identified seems like a very big problem. Rich countries hoarding up, gobbling up the vaccines before they're even distributed, meaning poor countries will not be able to vaccine their populations. It's a huge issue of justice here, right? But what needs to be done then to solve the problem, to make sure that the distribution of vaccines around the world is equitable?
So the situation shouldn't be like that. There are other options that are not really used. So we need the current companies that are producing the vaccines and the universities and research institutions to share the data, the know-how, and the intellectual property so that the other companies can produce. And you do that via another initiative from the World Health Organization, which is hardly talked about. It's something called COVID-19 Technology Access Pool. So that's a pool that pools the technology and the intellectual property and then license to companies that can produce these vaccines at of good quality.
What you're talking about, though, also makes you wonder about who is making these vaccines. The vaccines we're talking about have been produced by companies based in the United States or the United Kingdom. Of course, we know the Chinese are also producing a vaccine. The Russians have done so. To what extent are poorer countries creating their own vaccinations, and is that part of the issue?
So at the moment, as you said, we've got Russia and China. There's also one vaccine from India being researched and developed now. And these countries, they've gone for clinical trials with other countries like, you know, South Africa, Indonesia, quite a number of countries in Latin America, Middle East. But the problem with the Chinese and Russian vaccine is that we don't really know much about them. You know, some of these companies have the ability to produce, the capacity to produce, but maybe not all the technology that is necessary to produce. That's why we're saying sharing technology is important. So don't forget that these technologies are developed by taxpayers' money, and therefore the vaccine should be available to these people everywhere.
And what's the result of that not being available to people everywhere, of vaccine nationalism, of rich countries hoarding the vaccine and leaving everybody else out?
Actually, it's short-sighted because, you know, apart from it being morally wrong, it's from a public health ground, it's wrong because you vaccinate your people, but you continue to fight the virus at your borders. And the other thing is you won't have your economy back because who do you trade with? Where would you get the supply chain when you're worried about everything coming from a non-vaccinated country, as it were? So it doesn't make sense on moral ground, public health ground, and economic ground.
Dr. Moga Kamal Yani, Policy Advisor to the People's Vaccine Alliance, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
What will be the political fallout from President Trump's surprise decision to stand against the massive spending bill that Congress passed this week, which was just in time to get millions of people extra help before unemployment benefits start to expire the day after Christmas? Last night, in a video that reportedly caught aides off guard, the president again falsely claimed the election was stolen from him, demanded Congress increase direct payments to people to $2,000, and said this:
I'm also asking Congress to immediately get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from this legislation and to send me a suitable bill, or else the next administration will have to deliver a COVID relief package, and maybe that administration will be me.
So, threatening to derail relief and an election. Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to talk with you.
And Bill Press, the Democrat.
Hello, Robin. Good to be back.
And great to talk to you both. And Alice, you've been tweeting like a woman with her hair on fire, saying, don't do this. You know, a relief bill needs to be celebrated and signed, not vetoed. I mean, he can veto it, but then the Congress will have to come back and vote. And but the point is, you're a strategist. Why is President Trump doing this?
That's the $10 million question, right, Robin? Look, I think we can all agree that it is long overdue and past time for COVID relief money to get in the pockets and in the bank accounts of people across this country who are hurting. The pork barrel projects, on the other hand, have no business being in the COVID relief package. But this is where we are. This was the agreement that we had in Congress with Republicans and Democrats. And in order to get one, we needed the other. And look, I agree with the president that these pork barrel projects don't need to be part of this. But this is where we are. And these are the kind of points and conversations that should have been had long ago. He put Steven Mnuchin in there to make these deals and have these negotiations with Nancy Pelosi and Democrats. And it's a little bit late now. It's almost as though Republicans and Democrats got the ball to the 1-yard line, and he's Lucy with the football, pulling it out from front of them.
Well, actually, they crossed the goal. You know, they voted for it. And Bill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, yeah, hey, let's get $2,000 checks done this week before the government shuts down if the spending bill goes down in flames. In other words, if he doesn't sign it, holds on to it. But notice, Bill, we're talking about this instead of the president's many pardons from last night. Your thoughts why he's doing this?
Well, we can still talk about the pardons, but let's stick with this for just a while. I mean, this is really crazy. I mean, I would agree that this stimulus bill is too little, too late, and it's got stuff in it that doesn't belong in it. But as Ella said, that was the deal. My question is, where the hell has Donald Trump been for the last 2 or 3 months when Steve Mnuchin, representing the White House, let's remember, representing the president, was involved in these negotiations? The president, since November 3rd, has probably had 100 meetings in the Oval Office about how to overturn the elections. He has not had one single meeting, not one, with congressional leadership about the stimulus package. Meanwhile, Americans are hurting. American businesses are hurting. And until yesterday afternoon, the White House was saying the president was going to sign this. And then last night, suddenly, he pulls this stunt, which may be just his way of getting back in the news. Who knows? But I think we have to point out, he pulled the rug out from under the American people. He's pulled the rug out from under American businesses, small businesses particularly. He's pulled the rug out from under Steve Mnuchin and Mitch McConnell and all the Republicans who believed him when he said, told them he would sign it. And he pulled the rug out from under two Senate candidates in Georgia
right.
who have been campaigning in support of this bill because Donald Trump told them he would sign it. It's crazy.
Well, Alice, I have to ask Alice, did he pull the rug out from under you? I mean, you're one of the strategists, a Republican, you know, working in Georgia, trying to get the GOP vote for the two Senate runoffs in 2 weeks, which will determine control of the Senate. Are Republicans Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in trouble because of this?
That remains to be seen. Look, I've been on the ground in Georgia working to get out the vote with conservative women and pro-life groups. And look, the momentum and the enthusiasm is strong in Georgia to reelect Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue because the policies of the Democratic candidates are not reflective of the people of Georgia. And look, I think while this is important and it certainly is a distraction from other issues, the Republican candidates in Georgia need to be singularly focused on reminding the voters in Georgia that their conservative values of fiscal responsibility and limited government and pro-life and Second Amendment, those are the issues that are reflective of Georgia and not the socialist policies of the Democratic candidates. And that's what I was with the Republican candidates just the other day. They made that point repeatedly, and Republican voters in Georgia understand that.
If I may, Robin, this is the worst kind of politics, I think. To label Raphael Warnock, a pastor, the pastor for the last 15 years of Martin Luther King's church, as a socialist. Everybody knows it's not true. It's disgusting. John Ossoff, who worked in the Congress for John Lewis, who worked in the Congress for Hank Lang, the other congressman down there. These are not socialists. They represent the new Georgia. I don't want to, you know, we can debate this whole election if you want about Kelly Loeffler, who spends more time making financial deals than governing. Same thing with David Perdue, 2,600 and some financial transactions in the last 8 years. He hasn't been doing his job as a senator. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a clear choice between the new Georgia and the old Georgia. But my point is that Donald Trump is not helping the situation in Georgia when he comes out with this crazy threat to veto a bill that they've been running on because he asked them to.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask about
Donald Trump could go out. If I just finished. Donald Trump could go out of office with a big deal here signing this legislation. It would be a great win for Republicans. Instead, he screws the whole thing up. Doesn't make any sense.
I mean, there's a lot of things he could have done, Alice, as you know, in the last several weeks. He could have, as someone said, been there, you know, when the first plane landed with the vaccines that he purportedly got in motion. But he just completely ignored all of that to talk about, you know, this stolen election. But I want to talk about something else that is, I think, not getting talked about as much today because of what's happened with the bill, and that is the pardons. The video about the relief bill was posted 14 minutes after the president granted this slew of clemencies including two people who lied in the FBI's investigation of his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, three corrupt former Republican congressmen, and those American contractors who killed innocent civilians in Iraq. They were charged with that, working for a firm then owned by the brother of President Trump's education secretary. Alice, I mean, your thoughts on this?
Look, as president, he has his purview and he has the authority to issue pardons and commutations. And look, we can go through history of presidents that have done controversial pardons and commutations. And I think the president is certainly within his authority and with his within his power to grant these. There certainly are questions as to why certain people and why at this time. But in addition to all the high-profile names that we talk about, if you go down, there are many people that will be pardoned that were unjustly convicted, unjustly sentenced, and those are the people we need to focus on. Those are the people that are getting pardons and getting their life back on track. That those are the majority of these pardons that we will see between now and inauguration that need to have the focus of the media and America, because that is what the real power of pardons is all about.
Bill?
I beg to differ. Of course, pardons are for people who have been unjustly convicted or unjustly punished. That's what the pardon process is all about. It comes from the Department of Justice and recommendations to the president. That's not where these came from. Let's remember, there are three crooked congressmen here that he pardoned. There are two people who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI in the Mueller investigation. There are four contractors who shot and killed innocent civilians in Iraq, which really hurt the United States' image in that part of the world. And why did they get a pardon? Only because they're political cronies of Donald Trump. Alice is right. This is his prerogative. But he has used his prerogative to pardon political cronies and people who are guilty and did not come through the Justice Department. They wouldn't even be recommended by the Justice Department. Donald Trump is using this power.
I just want to make sure we've asked about Russia and the hacking of the past week and President-elect Joe Biden. Some Washington watchers have said Trump's outbursts yesterday came from him watching Biden's dominance of the news cycle, because yesterday we know Joe Biden blasted Donald Trump for not saying who's responsible for that massive cyber hack of government computers this month. Let's listen.
Cyber attacks must be treated as a serious threat by our leadership at the highest levels. We can't let this go unanswered.
That means I have to ask you, Alice, do you worry about what Russia must have or might have on President Trump that he is so leery of ever blaming them for what our own intelligence agencies and his own State Department say they're responsible for?
I say this, Robin. I trust our military intelligence officials. I trust Mike Pompeo with regard to this. And I do believe that Russia was behind this. But there are also, as some have said, others that are just as responsible for serious similar acts of cyber hacking. And it's important to take this into perspective. I think Joe Biden may have gotten ahead of his skis a little bit, because this is espionage. It's not an act of war.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Quick. All right, nope, time out. We'll get you next week. Alice Stewart, the Republican, Bill Press, the Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, thanks.
You too. And there's a massive operation underway to get the coronavirus vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna out. But many still have questions. So we're joined on Skype by Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine, for a lightning round of sorts. Dr. Hotez, you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. We know two doses for the vaccines, but how long does it take the vaccine to work?
So usually it'd be about a week after the second dose that you could reliably think you're going to have significant levels of what are called virus neutralizing antibodies. And that's been one of the most important links to protective immunity. It's not the only thing, but that's when you really start seeing the virus neutralizing antibodies go up, a week after the second dose. For the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine, there's the J&J vaccine that was developed initially by Dan Baruch's group at Harvard Medical School, that the hope is after a single dose, but that may be the exception. Ours, for instance, that we're accelerating after two doses, so usually about a week after the second dose.
And how long does that protection last? Because we know if you have COVID-19, it can sometimes go away.
And the answer is we have no clue. And the reason we have no clue is because the clinical trials haven't been going on long enough. So this is a really important point, you know, because some of the vaccines may not protect as much, say, as the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines. But I make the point, on the other hand, they may have more durable and long lasting protective immunity. So we don't know. And and the point is, don't wait. Don't try to cherry pick which vaccine you're going to take. Get what you can. And if it turns out the one you got is not long lasting, durable protection, it's okay. You can get potentially a third dose of the vaccine, the same one or a different one.
Well, and what does it mean? I mean, so you've got after a week some protection. Does that mean people who've been vaccinated can gather with other people who've been vaccinated?
Well, here's the thing. The clinical trials were done to only look to see if the vaccines protect against symptomatic infection and severe infection. What we don't know if it halts what's asymptomatic transmission. In other words, potentially, you could be vaccinated, exposed to the virus, and still have the infection with no symptoms and are shedding virus in your nose and mouth. And we're actually a number of groups are now looking at that. Some of the vaccines experimentally had that issue. We just don't know. So at least for the first few months after people are getting vaccinated, the advice is still continue to do the social distancing and masks. And then as we approach a greater percentage of the population in the U.S. getting vaccinated, eventually we could start easing some of those things. But we don't know enough right now to do that.
Because it eventually knocks back the virus because it's got no place to live. Look, for people who have questions about safety, do we know how safe it is?
Well, we know that it's certainly safe in the large phase 3 clinical trials. These are large, well-powered studies between 30,000 and 60,000 individuals, safe and effective. You know, could there be rare safety events that you wouldn't see in a 30 to 60,000 person trial? Yes, that's happened. But again, they'd be rare events, and the risk of getting the virus is so overwhelming. Remember, the only thing that you know is going to keep you out of the ICU or the hospital is getting these vaccines. And that's why you want to get vaccinated, at least initially.
Well, and let's repeat, the other thing that we know, until you get the vaccine, the thing that will keep you out is wearing a mask and socially distancing and not traveling.
Absolutely.
Please.
Absolutely.
For this holiday. Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Always happy to come back.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has appointed his Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, to take Kamala Harris's seat in the U.S. Senate when she becomes vice president next month. In an interview with KQED's Scott Schaefer, Padilla reflected on his career.
To think that in one generation, you know, my family's gone from being the cooks and the house cleaners to now not just serving as one of the constitutional officers for the state of California, but being a member of the United States Senate.
Scott Schaefer is politics editor at KQED and host of Political Breakdown. And Scott, Padilla making history here. He's going to become the first Latino senator from California. Tell us more about him and what kind of reaction you're hearing.
Yeah, well, Padilla is 47 years old, so pretty young by Senate standards. Parents both born in Mexico. He grew up in Los Angeles. As you heard, his parents were working class. Padilla left California to go to MIT. He actually has a degree in engineering, but his passion was clearly politics. Shortly after college, he went to work as an assistant to Dianne Feinstein in the U.S. Senate. And at the ripe old age of 26, he got elected to the L.A. City Council, quickly rose to become president, and then he was off to Sacramento, where he was in the state legislature, and then Secretary of State, which is where he is now. The reaction's been mostly positive. You know, it's historic, but there's been some criticism from some who wanted him to name a black woman to the seat.
Well, let's talk about that, because now this means that there will no longer be any black woman in the United States Senate when Kamala Harris becomes vice president. What more can you tell us about that debate?
Well, there was a lot of pressure on Newsom even before the election, before it was clear that Kamala Harris was going to become vice president, you know, for all the reasons you would expect. But, you know, Newsom and Padilla have been very longtime political allies, going all the way back to when Gavin Newsom was mayor of San Francisco. And he likes to make history, Gavin Newsom does, and this is a historic appointment. And a also, you know, Padilla is going to have to run on his own in 2 years when Kamala Harris's term is up. He's already run twice statewide. He's got good name ID, the ability to raise money, and he knows how to legislate. So I think, you know, although Newsom was pulled in different directions, he ended up with Padilla. And I think, by and large, the reaction has been pretty positive.
And less than a minute here, but how do you think he might continue or break with the legacy left by Senator Harris?
Well, you know, he got into politics because of some of the anti-immigrant ballot measures in California. He's got the perspective of someone who's the son of immigrants, working class. So I would describe him as a pragmatic progressive, liberal on issues like climate change and the environment, gun control. But he's going to be pretty cautious, I think, like Newsom and Kamala Harris on the issues like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal. I don't think you're going to see him taking a far left position on issues like that.
KQED's Scott Schaefer, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Tom Hanks is in a new movie that comes out on Christmas Day. He plays an aging Civil War vet named Jefferson Kidd who travels around Texas reading newspaper stories to audiences hungry for news of the world. Kidd encounters a 10-year-old girl named Cicada along the way. Cicada is white, though she'd been kidnapped by the Kiowa tribe 6 years earlier and raised as one of their own. U.S. soldiers have killed her Kiowa family, so Cicada is left alone, and Kidd decides to take her back to her only living relatives. On their dangerous journey, the two form a bond, which starts by learning each other's language.
See that bird? Bird.
Bird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
News of the World is based on the book by Paulette Giles and is directed by Paul Greengrass. He's known for directing the Jason Bourne films as well as docudramas like Captain Phillips, and he joins me now. Paul, welcome. Great to speak with you.
And you. Very nice to be here.
Yeah, so, you know, this film, it's not a spy thriller, and it's not based on real events like some of your other movies. What was it like to make a Western? Was that a big change?
It was, actually. I was looking to do something else. I mean, you know, I think if you're a filmmaker, you have to kind of try new things. And there was just something about the story of this lonely newsreader. You know, he's lost everything. But the act of reading the news, the act of storytelling is a healing thing. That and it connects people, you know, and that's what he's doing. And then, of course, he meets the mysterious young girl in the woods. And essentially, the journey they go on, I mean, ostensibly it's to take her back to her surviving family, but really it's a journey in search of where to belong in a divided world. And I thought, well, that's really about now.
Yeah, that point you're making about the divided times that we live in, I think is important. And so I think we should also look at the era that this film is set in. It's Texas during Reconstruction. The Civil War is just recently over, so the campaign against indigenous people can now begin in full force. The railroad is about to come through, which, of course, as we know, will change the American West.
Yep.
How did the period of this film resonate with you?
In all those ways, the sense of bitter division, the shadow of loss and grief, which I think we all are going through now, the sense that technology is going to transform our world, as I think, I don't know about you, but I feel that very strongly. I mean, just on the level of vaccines alone.
You know, I was thinking you're making a Western in 2020 or thereabouts, and that's got to be different. You know, you have to be sensitive to the way that indigenous people are portrayed in film now.
Yes.
How did you navigate that?
The way I navigated was to see this story for what it is. It's the story of these two characters, the lonely newsreader and the little girl who was kidnapped when she was a child and brought up by the Kiowa tribe as if she were their own. I'm not representing the Kiowa tribe or anything like that. Though that said, you know, the first thing I did was reach out, and we had extensive help from the elders of the Kiowa tribe, and in those scenes where they are depicted, they are members of the Kiowa tribe.
Well, Paul Greengrass, let's hear a little bit more from the film here. In this scene, because you're right, it is about other things. In fact, it's about a man named Captain Kidd, who is a newsreader and is a Civil War veteran. And here he is in this scene reading the news for a group of people who work for a murderous boss in Erath, Texas. And it's obvious that Kidd is trying to get those workers to rise up against their boss. Let's listen.
I'm here to tell you about the 11 men
who lived.
Yeah.
Who survived that fire. The 11 men who fought back against their deadly fate.
Yes. Yes.
Thought I told you to read from the E-Rat, Pat.
Well, see, Mr. Farley, I was wondering if folks might prefer some storytelling from places outside of E-Rat.
Well, I'll tell you what, anybody who is a fan of Tom Hanks is going to love this film. You've worked with him before. What does he bring to a film now, at this stage in his career?
Well, everything in a way, you know. Because in the end, when you make a film, that relationship filmmaker with the leading actor, you carry the load ultimately on your shoulders together, the two of you. And it often feels like you're walking through sort of a dense forest in a fog at night with a small flashlight, and you're trying to find the way. And it becomes an endless process of shining your is it that way? Or maybe it's this way, you know, and you're you have 10,000 conversations during the making of the film to try and get to the right place. And there's no doubtier comrade that you could have in that journey, nor more experienced a person could you have. But I agree. Look, I think it's one of his very best performances.
Well, the performance is very strong. You're right. But the challenge you face, or the tough thing I think you face, is that it's opening in theaters at this really terrible time for movie going.
Yeah,
the film has, you know, beautiful vistas. It seems to be crying out to be seen in a theater, but it's tough. People aren't going to theaters now. Does that hurt in a way that this film won't
yes,
be
it does. It does hurt a lot, yes. I mean, look, it's creatively disappointing / devastating because people aren't going to see it on the big screen as it was made to be seen with all that beautiful cinematography from Darius Wolski and those beautiful performances on a big screen. But I think we do gain something that in a way is beyond that, and that is making a statement of faith in the movies. If we believe that things will come back, and I do believe it, that they will come back, and I believe people will be in theatres in the summer, we have to act as we believe. Light a tiny beacon in a dark night and say the dawn will come.
Well, and it doesn't take away from the act of creating the film. Writer, director Paul Greengrass, the new film is News of the World. It will be released on Christmas Day. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really good to be here.
This year, at least 322,000 Americans have died from COVID-19. It can be difficult to fathom the humanity behind those numbers. How do we activate our own empathy when we've been so humbled by this tragedy? Well, that's the essential work of Faces of COVID, a project that shares the stories of the people behind the statistics. This one, from member station WBUR, features Karen Nassimbeni of Linfield, Massachusetts. Karen and her husband, Stephen T. Richard, were both infected with the coronavirus in early March. Both became gravely ill. Only Karen survived.
When coronavirus reached the area, I was already really sick with a sinus infection. So I was pretty run down. But Stephen and I, we went to depths of illness that neither of us had ever experienced before. On the morning of St. Patrick's Day, he became gravely ill, and that's when I said to him, I'm going to call an ambulance. And he said, no. He said, please drive me. And so I drove him to Winchester Hospital. And when we got there, you know, there was a staging area because it was total pandemonium. And they came out and they took him immediately because he was so sick. And when he got out of the car, he turned around and he smiled at me and he said, I love you. And he blew me a kiss. And that was the last time I saw him. I met Stephen through a mutual friend, and I looked at him and I thought, my God, he's the boy next door. Stephen was probably about 5'8 in height, He was, you know, in very good health, you know, good shape, because he was so physical in his work as a contractor. And he had very kind, loving eyes. He was passionate about children and animals, neither of which he had. We tried getting pregnant, but went through 7 rounds of in vitro and it didn't work. He was a very sensitive, gentle soul. I mean, we had a very charmed life together. And the beautiful part of that is it wasn't lost on me in the moment. Like, I can look back and appreciate it now, but in the moment, I knew how special it was. We had a tradition on Christmas morning that we never did big gifts. So we would do stockings, and our traditions were we would put a clementine in the toe of the stocking, and we would fill the stocking with gifts. We would have the Eric Tingstad, Nancy Rumble CD called The Gift would be playing in the background, and we would eat poppycock in bed. It's kind of like Cracker Jacks on steroids. And that is one of my biggest fears, is Christmas morning and not having him there to eat the poppycock in bed. So instead, what we're doing is we're buying poppycock and we are delivering it to people so that they will know what that joy feels like to eat poppycock in bed on Christmas morning, because it's really delicious. I was admitted to Winchester Hospital on St. Patrick's Day. I was in a medically induced coma for 31 days, and I woke up on April 20th, which was Stephen's birthday. It was like he sent me back. When I woke up, my sister said to me, "You know, KK, I'm never going to lie to you." And I said, "I know that." And she said, "Stephen didn't make it." And I said, "I know that." And she said, "Well, how do you know?" And I said, "Because he was with me the whole time I was in the coma. I was having these horrific hallucinations, and he was always there in the corner of the room with a glow around him and just smiling at me. He never spoke to me, and he would just kind of shake his head knowingly, like, you're going to be okay." I am a singer. I've sung my whole life. I sang to Stephen, "Fly Me to the Moon" was our song. I sang it to him on our wedding day. You know, I love "Fly Me to the Moon" now because we think about Stephen living in the, you know, out in the universe and in the moon. And so, let's see. "Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you."
That story produced by WBUR's Franny Carr-Toth and Chloe Axelson. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is